From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman. We talk with star John David Washington and the man he plays, Ron Stallworth. He's the black undercover cop who infiltrated the KKK in the 1970s.
I never lost sight of the fact, in spite of the many times that my sergeant and I would be cracking up laughing at the idiocy of these fools, we never lost sight of the fact that they represented an organization of hate. An organization that was has been defined as domestic terrorist.
And Rosie and the Riveters and feminist country songs. All that coming right up. We'll start today with one of the most anticipated movie openings of the summer. Spike Lee's Black Klansman tells the unbelievable true story of how a black police officer in Colorado infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan in the early 1970s. Here's a clip from the film's trailer.
This is David Duke,
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
God. Last time I checked, what can I do for
him? Well, since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews, Mexicans and Irish, Italians and Chinese. But my mouth to God's ears, I really hate those black rats.
Ron Stallworth was an undercover cop in Colorado Springs when he established contact with the KKK by telephone. What happened from there is a remarkable investigation in which he partnered with a white cop to double as Stallworth for in-person meetings with the Klan. I recently spoke with Stallworth and the actor who plays him in the movie, John David Washington, and we began with Ron's writing his memoir, Black Klansman, which is the basis for the film.
March 2013, I started writing, and it took me 9 months before I finally said, okay, that's enough, I'm done. And then I took it to a friend of mine who was a retired Santa Ana police officer, and he had a publishing company that published books for police and firemen. He read it, published it, and we were off and running.
John David, the book tells us a lot about the actual events around this investigation. It doesn't say a lot about who Ron was, how he behaved, how he thought of himself. When you are looking at reference material and trying to get into this character, what was your process like for making sure that you were representing as an actor the person that you were going to be playing?
Yes, proper representation, I think, starts with the climb and the time that this story is taking place. And so even before I had direct contact and access to Ron Stallworth, I wanted to understand what it meant to be a black man in the late 60s and 70s. So my entry point, my entryway was music. I cut out all R&B and hip hop, you know, for a couple months. And I would go to sleep to Soul Train, YouTube clips of Soul Train every night.
Let's check out that Soul Train line now. The Soul Train gang to the music of Earth, Wind, and Fire, and Mighty, Mighty.
You know, I had an extensive playlist dedicated to music of that time. I watched Superfly. I had that on repeat. You know, a whole bunch of documentaries. One specifically was the Black Panther mixtape. Well, I really enjoyed that one. I watched that a couple times. So I just wanted to understand the what was going on in those times, and that this was all prior to meeting Ron. And then when I got to meet Ron at the table read, and he passed around the Ku Klux Klan membership card, sort of brought it all together from the book. And then separate from the book, obviously I had a whole bunch of information from that. I just wanted to talk to the man, you know, what he liked, what Ron liked. He listened to music too. You know, he's a person, you know. And I wanted to sort of simplify things before jumping into it. I didn't want to try to emulate. I didn't want to just mimic. You know, I wanted to basically asked him. I didn't use his words, but I asked him for his spirit and his soul for a couple months. And he was so generous and rented it out to me.
A huge part of this story is the voice that Ron uses on the telephone.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit different from the voice he uses in ordinary conversation.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
That is a media hype that was created. I don't know who created
fake
it.
News.
Whether it was a studio. Yeah, it's fake news. Well, I don't know if it was a studio or some reporter wrote a story that just latched on. The fact of the matter is, when I initiated the phone conversation, I talked to them exactly like I'm talking to you right now.
Yes, sir.
There was no attempt to disguise my voice. When you do undercover work, you have to stay as close to who you are and what you are as possible, because if you try to put on a persona that is totally foreign to you, you cannot afford to slip up, because that may be the difference between life and death. You don't mimic anybody unless you have a good talent for that, because it's too dangerous. So I spoke exactly as I'm speaking right now. There was no, as I've read in the media, there was no white voice at work. It was simply Ron Stallworth talking to these guys as Ron Stallworth. It was the language that I used.
Right. And it's important to note, too, that David Duke was immediately impressed by your language and your diction, and that he believed and specifically pointed out words that you used and pronunciations that you used that made him 100% confident that you were not black.
Yeah, David Duke's an idiot. That was one of the funniest conversations and incidents in this whole investigation, was when he told me, well, first of all, I baited him. I asked him, aren't you worried? Aren't you ever worried about some smart alecky N-word person, except we said the word. Aren't you ever worried about some smart alecky N-word person calling you up pretending to be black so that he gave information on the Ku Klux Klan? He said, no, I'm never worried about that. I said, why? He said, because I can always tell when I'm talking to one of them. And I said, what do you mean? He said, take you, for example. I can tell you're a pure Aryan white man by the way you pronounce the English language. I said, I still don't understand. He said, pure Aryan whites like you and I, we speak English correctly. We say, for example, take the word or letter R. We say R. Whereas the N-word person, they will say R-A. He said, that's the way you determine whether you're talking to one of them on the phone, is get them to say that word. It's a dead giveaway as to who they are. I said, Mr. Duke, I want to thank you for that. If you hadn't told me that, I wouldn't have known it. And I appreciate that. And from now on, I'll make sure I'm not talking to an N-word person by checking out their use of the English language. So from that point on, whenever I called David Duke up, I would find the way to say, oh, Mr. Duke, how are you doing? Mr. Duke, how are the wife and kids? Are you coming to Colorado Springs? And that idiot never realized he was being made a fool of by a N-word person, a black man.
Coming up, more with Ron Stallworth, the author of the memoir Black Klansman, and John David Washington, who plays Stallworth in Spike Lee's movie. Now we'll get back to my conversation about Black Klansman with a film star, John David Washington, and the real man that he's playing. Washington stars as former police officer Ron Stallworth, whose story is the focus of the new Spike Lee movie. It comes out on August 10th. In the 1970s, Stallworth became the first black officer in the Colorado Springs Police Department. In collaboration with a white colleague who played Stallworth in person, Stallworth went undercover to investigate the Klan as part of a local effort to stop the hate group. Black Klansman walks a fine line between funny moments and the dark realities of the Klan's legacy and the group's potential for violence. I asked Washington and Stallworth about that balancing of comedy and danger. We pick up the conversation now with Washington, who's, by the way, the son of Denzel Washington, talking about the movie's tone.
Well, for me, like for the filming process of it all, it was my mission, it was my job to accurately, you know, tell Ron's story from a spiritual standpoint, from how he was feeling. And I didn't look at it as a comedy. It didn't feel like a comedy when I was filming, during my process. You know, Ron took his job very seriously. So did I. And what was happening, you know, with the story, I mean, it's on the audience to kind of find the comedy in it, I guess. But I didn't play into it, neither did Adam. You know, so, and like you said, they were very dangerous people, and they were organized. You know, this is organized hate we're talking about. So I had to be very careful with not making a joke out of it, and I didn't, you know, and it was very serious to me.
I didn't want to say what trap, but that Peckerwood had a gun in my face. And he was an ass hair away from pulling the trigger.
And he didn't.
But he could have. And then I would have been dead. For what? Stopping some jerk-offs from playing dress-up?
Flip, it's intel.
Well, I'm not risking my life to prevent some rednecks from lighting a couple sticks on fire.
This is the job. What's your problem?
That's my problem. For you, it's a crusade. For me, it's a job.
I never lost sight of the fact, in spite of the many times that my sergeant and I would be cracking up laughing at the idiocy of these fools, we never lost sight of the fact that they represented an organization of hate, an organization that was has been defined as domestic terrorists. We were fully aware of that every time we made contact with them, either by phone or when I sent Chuck in to represent me for face-to-face meetings. They were carrying guns. They were gun nuts. They openly bragged about it, showed the guns to Chuck at one of the meetings. So we knew that these guys were armed or had the means to be armed, and at any time, if something had jumped off, gunplay was a possibility. I never lost sight that they were potentially dangerous individuals.
This is kind of a hypothetical, but I've really been thinking about this issue a lot, and that is that this story unfolds in the 70s, and yet the fact that this film is coming out today, to me, and I think to a lot of other people, changes the way that we see it, because we're living in an era of the alt-right, of white nationalism, certainly what's happened in Charlottesville and other incidents, I think put this period story in contemporary context. And I'm wondering if you think, both of you, that the story is different today than it might have been had this film come out a couple years after the actual investigation.
Well, I think what Spike did beautifully in executing was the how generational hate is and the language of it and the resurgence of forces that be that promote that hate. We see it in the film. We see Birth of a Nation. We see, you know, that with that and through Hollywood, how it, you know, was a resurgence for the Klan. We see David Duke, who put a new face on it, a new neighborly, you know, nice white man face on hate.
Today we are privileged to be among white men and white women, such as yourselves, real warriors for the real America, the America that our ancestors fought and died for. Yes. The true white American race, the backbone from whence came our great Southern heritage.
And then the groups you mentioned today in the contemporary times. So I think those common themes we're just seeing, you know, just are very important in this film and kind of showcase how we have a lot of work to do.
The movie could not have been made It could not have been made at any other time except this one. If it had been made 2 years, 3 years earlier, it wouldn't have the impact that it's having right now in the public mind, and they haven't even seen it yet for the most part. Because Duke wanted to achieve high political office, and he wanted to do that from the standpoint of promoting his Klan ideology. Well, he didn't do it. He got as high as the Louisiana House of Representatives. But he tried to, he ran for vice president once and president once. David Duke wanted to be where Donald Trump is, and so the movie is very, very contemporary, even though it is events that took place in the past.
We're talking with Ron Stallworth, the author of the memoir Black Klansmen, and John David Washington, who plays Stallworth in the film. John David, the film and the book also talk a lot about the 1915 movie Birth of a Nation. It's used basically for Klan movie night, and it really espouses a point of view that the Klan finds really attractive. And it made me think a little bit about how movies shape culture and views about race and how they kind of solidify and codify those ideas. And I'm wondering if you think, A, that's true, and B, if movies today can be corrective in some way about addressing issues of perception and bigotry.
movies have sort of these points of views, and they like Spike Lee for sure, been doing it for decades, been able to sort of celebrate, you know, certain men and women of cultures that are not white, and celebrate their differences and celebrate the different colors of personalities and through the neighborhoods, and he's been doing it for decades. So I definitely feel like it can be inspirational sometimes when you see, and unfortunately, Birth of a Nation was too for certain people that believe in that sort of thing. So we got to be very responsible with our art, you know, and know that you know, this is for the people, and the people can sort of take from it what they want. And it can be, like you said, corrective in a way too. It could be a lesson. This film doesn't seem to me to be suggestive, though. It doesn't. There's lessons in it. There's messages, very strong messages in it. But the package and delivery of those messages are in an entertainment form are very like, I know, detailed in the way that only Spike could do it, which I'm very proud of. And I love when films do that. They're not just hitting you over the head with a listen, and you should listen up to this, or you should be taking this in. I don't, as an audience member, necessarily want to be told what to believe, whether that be the bad guy or the good guy. You know, I want to decipher that for myself and the people in the audience as well. And this film, to me, just lays out what happened as the book does.
Spike, in my opinion, was at the top of his game in making this movie. And saying that, I want to point out that, to me, Malcolm X was the best movie he ever made. I love Malcolm X. But I think he surpassed himself in putting this movie together, because
wow,
he was able to weave the historical thread between the Confederacy to Charlottesville to David Duke to Donald Trump. And I think Spike is a master at doing what he does. And in this case, I think he surpassed his own mastery.
John David, I think you know one of the actors in Malcolm X, don't you?
Well, I think we all do. I mean, we all saw it. Well, I shouldn't assume we all saw it, but yeah, no, I know him a little bit.
I want to ask you both a little bit about the coda on this film. There's footage from Charlottesville and some other things that happened more recently. I understand there was some debate about whether or not that was the proper way to end the film. Should it be in? Should it be out? How would you say that you each reacted to the film when you saw it with the coda?
I thought it was unbeknownst to me. I didn't know it was going to be in there. And it shows that, yeah, again, like it was an entertaining movie, but let's not lose focus on what's going on and what we're talking about. Like it's happening still. It's happening in a new package, in a new delivery, a new face.
Ron, what about you? What about the coda?
I sat in the theater mesmerized the first time. I've seen the movie 3 times now. The first time I was mesmerized in the last 5 to 10 minutes when you're getting all this coming at you. I think Spike was very gutsy going to Heather Heyer's mother and asking her permission.
That was noble.
Heather, we should say, was a peaceful protester who was run over by a car at Charlottesville and killed.
And I wish I could see her so that I could thank her for giving him permission.
Yeah, same here.
Because that culminates and polishes off. That's the exclamation point on that whole movie, when you see her daughter murdered as violently as it was, and when you see all that action unfolding. That woman is, as far as I'm concerned, she's a saint.
Ron Stallworth is the author of the memoir Black Klansman. John David Washington plays Ron Stallworth in the film version of his memoir. Ron and John David, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Black Klansman opens on August 10th. Coming up on The Frame, we visit with the feminist country trio, Rosie and the Riveters. Now, Rosie and the Riveters. They're a Canadian vocal group who are inspired by folk, country, and 1940s jazz. The trio is made up of Alexis Norman, Allison Ray, and Faraday Olson, and they all share the lead vocals equally. Their group's name is a nod to the World War II Rosie the Riveter poster, whose We Can Do It slogan and buff bicep is still a symbol for women's empowerment. Rosie and the Riveters' second album takes that a step further, called Ms. Behave. It contains feminist anthems, including the band's response to the Me Too movement, the song I Believe You. The group is donating a large portion of its proceeds to female causes around the world and organizations like RAIN, that's the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. The trio visited our studios and spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett. Here's Rosie and the Riveters.
My name is Alexis Normand.
I'm Allison Ray.
And my name is Faraday Olson.
We are from Saskatchewan, the land of living skies, where the sky pretty much stretches out just like the ocean does.
There's nothing to do in Saskatchewan. As you know, it's above Montana and North Dakota. So there's a saying, you either play hockey or you play an instrument. And that's why there's so many musicians that are coming out of Saskatchewan.
I've curled up in an unmade bed, so I wouldn't be alone. I've stopped myself from walking out just to have a home.
For this last record, Misbehave, we really wanted to do something really collaborative. So we secluded ourselves in a cabin in northern Saskatchewan and we pumped out the music.
We wrote a lot of bad songs, too. Yeah, there's a couple topics we needed to try more than once. And it wasn't until it was all done and we brought them to our producer that we realized we're actually pretty feminist.
If I dared to be a dragon with fire on my tongue.
So, we have a song about the gender pay gap. We have a song that supports survivors of sexual assault. There are many songs that I think just talk about what it's like to be a woman these days.
I dare have a vision. I dare raise my hand. Cause I want more than I'm given. So I burn, burn, burn the plan. I wanna be king.
It's interesting when you look at like Loretta Lynn, the Pill, or like Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, and you're like, wow, they're these like feminist anthems deep in what I would consider like a very conservative kind of genre. But at the same time, I think it's been interesting performing our music in many markets. And in North Carolina, where we were like, oh, I wonder how they're going to feel about this, the women were really into it.
Well, I have been known to like a little rum.
Certainly has a lot of sassy attitude in there. And I think that's what we tried to translate vocally, like, the song starts off with super sassy, it's really fun. Even just the syllable like there's so much that could be said in a It could be a loving it could be a savoring but this one's like don't mess with me.
So Misbehave sort of was an idea that I had floating around in my head, and I really liked the idea of challenging the status quo of women and like, I'm going to behave the way I want to. And when someone says you need to behave like a lady, I say however I behave is like a lady, because I am a lady.
You got to behave. So I'll misbehave. Behave. I'll behave in my grave. There's lots of sinners. I don't care what they say. What they say. Call me misbehave. Call me misbehave.
It was part of our creative challenge too. Mm-hmm. Deciphering when and how to be funny and witty. And when and how to be heartfelt and sensitive, mm-hmm. and choosing our approach appropriately depending on what we're talking about.
I believe you. When they ask, what did you wear? I believe you. When you say you were scared.
Well, we wrote I Believe You in February of 2017. So this was before the Me Too movement went viral. And it was really just drawing upon our own experiences and the stories of our friends. And I'd come across three words that are really important to share with individuals who are going through this experience. So that's kind of where we started. I said, why don't we write a song called I Believe You?
Something that speaks to a greater conversation. Like Faraday said, Tarana Burke began the Me Too movement over 10 years ago. So it's something that, we're finally talking about in our society and on a larger scale in our culture. And that doesn't mean that disclosing is easier necessarily, but it's certainly something that more people are being aware of, and Specifically for the song I Believe You, we've chosen to donate all monies collected from streaming and download sales. And in Canada, we've partnered with the YWCA of Canada, so we're giving them all that money that's generated through streaming and download. And then in the States, we're donating that money to RAIN. As we've performed it for audiences across North America, a lot of people have really connected to that song and will reach out, you know, on social media, in our email, in person at shows, and just say thank you for that message, because we live in a society that puts the onus of an assault on the survivor.
As a songwriter, I always hope that our music connects with people, and to see it connect on that level is something empowering as a songwriter. You know, we have this goal to be empowering, and it's sort of like the energy is being reciprocated.
I believe you. There's no need to explain. I believe you when they slander your name.
And that will do it for today. Remember to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
I believe you.